questions that could reveal your purpose in life? What if there were questions that could surface the change most meaningful to you? And what if answering those questions would give you the power to ignite? Welcome to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. These are big conversations that lead to self-discovery. Together, let's embark on the leader's journey and ignite meaningful change. Leaders usually do one of two things. They meaningfully challenge the status quo, or they meaningfully resist a challenge to the status quo. In this episode, Jonathan discovers that in realizing his vision of meaningful change, he has to do both. Luckily, not at the same time. He then struggles with his dislike for the word interest in answering this next Amplify question.
So Jonathan, as we begin card 27 in Amplify, I have a question for you that links us back to the first conversation that we had on Zoom. We were discussing, the three of us, the potential implications of going through this process as you were considering whether to accept the invitation. And one thing that I said to you was that were you to do this, the oldest part of you would have a voice. Do you recall that?
I do remember you saying that. It was a wonderful, mysterious line.
How does it feel to give that oldest part of you sound?
It's one of those ideas where I'm just struck first with the beauty of the line, the poetry of it. I'm just sort of enjoying that.
You can give it to Richard. I don't mind.
He would love it as well. He would love that. It speaks to something in this whole conversation. It really does. It's this constant back and forth. You know, there are all these tensions going on in the conversation. And one of them, one of the central ones, is the old and the new, the old and the new, the old and the new.
Yeah.
Right? So we break with the past and we stand on new ground. We break with the past and we stand on new ground. Fine. But I've scribbled once or twice in my notebook when we have those conversations, yes, but. The new, it's not a new planet. Yeah. The idea of a new planet doesn't interest me. That alienates me. That's not the home I'm looking for.
And I recall you saying that in London, and it's so on point for you. I totally hear that.
And it's part of the coming battle, or the battle that's already here and now for our human future.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, Elon Musk, I think, and let's not get personal. Sure, he's a lovely guy. Let's not get personal, but I think I mentioned this about the Christopher Nolan films. It's a theme through many of the Christopher Nolan films that there is a view which says we are not meant to finish here on this planet. This is just a staging post. I mean, great fun idea, but there's a darker reality to it, a darker agenda, which is happening right now.
Yes, what is it? Verbalize it.
It's the what I understand to be billions and billions being invested in Silicon Valley. Let's use that label. It's wider than that, but okay. Mm. It's a we know what that means. It's a label. Okay. Into, on the one hand, immortality, which paradoxically is not. Mm. That's not a human urge. Mm-hmm. That's an urge. What the urge is to escape the human. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, being human, such a drag. Mm. So inconvenient. Why do I have to die? Mm-hmm. Okay. It's a refusal of the human. It sounds like I want more humanity. It's not. It's a refusal mm-hmm. of what... It's a denial of what it means to be human. It's That's why it's profoundly wrong. Mm-hmm. Equally... Get me off this planet. Mm. Get me off this planet. Mm-hmm. I'm going to swear now. Get mm-hmm. me off this planet. Well, these fucking losers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Get me off this planet now. Yeah.
Maybe I'll get somewhere closer to home.
I don't know what these people think about the notion of home.
Good point.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be wild if eradicating homelessness on this planet led to the extinguishing of the potential for an automaton state. Where so much technology is infused into the human species that it doesn't exist down the line.
Right. But these are the battle lines that are being drawn now.
That many don't see.
Sure. And the danger here, and again, we're back to the old and the new, the old and the new, the old and the new. I catch myself tripping up on my own vision and saying, be careful here, be careful. Nostalgia is not a vision. You can't build a vision out of nostalgia.
That's right.
No. Okay. There may be things from the past. We've talked about rescuing things.
Yeah.
If you know something to be true and good,
yeah,
then rescue it.
Bring
absolutely.
It forth.
Absolutely.
Bring
yes.
it forth into the new ground.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, back to my first idea. I'm not interested in building a new planet. Yeah? Just doesn't interest me at all. It's not interesting per se. Making our human life together better, that interests me. Working with what we have interests me, you know. And again, that comes back to the link between the vision and our human selves, our fractured selves. How we find ways to live a better life as humans with each other, how we deal with the fact, how we don't lose courage when we learn that we are born frail, fragile, liable, open to temptation, born with demons, that we don't put down our weapons and say, oh, that's not fair. But we rise up and say, right, okay, what are we going to do about this?
I love that.
That interests me.
Touching on the, I don't want to be on another planet notion for a moment. Have you ever met anyone who, when you interacted with them, kind of felt like you were on a different planet?
Yeah, it happens all the time, doesn't it? We meet people amongst our closest circles. And that's the, isn't that the language we use?
Isn't that
wow.
Great? Yeah.
She was on a different planet. We say that.
So great. Yeah. It's
because we feel that distance is just so.
Yeah.
And that's coming back to the fractured nature of our societies at the moment. That is sometimes how we feel. People across the political aisle. We were talking about this yesterday with Morley, you know, it's not long ago. It is not long ago that people of different political parties would see each other and have a beer at the end of the working day. Is that some halcyon past that we will never live again? It's only 20 years ago. You know, so those moments where you have to, as you're trying to create something new, and this is where it's not nostalgia, this is where you're saying, oh, be careful. What are we going to lose here?
Preservation.
Yeah, that preservation, which is, it's what I would call the good human, natural, organic, conservative gene within us all. We all have it.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Haidt, the psychologist, would say we all have it, but in just in different degrees. And you know, as I've gotten older, I've discovered my small C conservative gene. That voice which says, whoa, hang on, before we throw this over the cliff, are we absolutely sure it has no value? Are we absolutely sure that this idea was wrong?
Or that it's died?
Or it's, yeah.
Yeah.
Can I interject here? Because you, by virtue of what you've just said, Jonathan, are illustrating the two often and usually distinct types of leadership. One is where you see a need, an opportunity, and choose to challenge what is now in a meaningful way to create the new, and you're doing that. Yeah. The other is at a time when what is meaningful is being challenged, then you lead the resistance to the obliteration of that because you see that it has value, needs to continue to exist. So you are uniquely manifesting both forms of leadership at the same time. And if we contrast that on the human level, we've spoken about Churchill over some of these conversations and the fact that he, his leadership during the war, World War II, was to protect the British sovereignty, right? So to resist the challenges that threatened British sovereignty. And then, you know, laudable, thank heavens, that he achieved that. Then the war ends, and you remember that he was turfed. Because that's not the kind of leadership the British people wanted.
Yeah, well said. Great example. And that's, there's something natural in that. What you've described to me sounds like a democracy running well, sort of being sensitive to its own needs at a particular time.
Yeah, because things had reached a different, I won't say equilibrium post-war, but they needed to build on the stability. It wasn't any longer about resisting. It was about igniting the new.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes
and, and rescuing the old, yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense.
So it calls for in being able to lead in both ways, it calls for tremendous discernment. Not judgment, but discernment as to what you see can remain and what you see needs to change. What do you bring with you to that new ground?
Yeah, yeah.
As you break from the past.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think you use the word resistance. I love that word resistance. It feels very relevant now. I think if we're trying to imagine and then put down the foundations for a new way of living together, so a shared home.
Shared home.
Right. So if we're trying to imagine a shared home and what that looks like, what it feels like, what are the first foundations that we're putting down? I think that can begin in that moment of discernment as an act of resistance before the building. And this is linked to ideas of intolerance, where in the old world, we are perhaps living in resistance to the prevailing norms, the prevailing assumptions, the prevailing culture, trying to live a good life, but which is going against the grain of the prevailing culture. And so our own personal lives become acts of resistance. My sense, you were saying in the previous card, which was, it was another tough question. Can you imagine the people? What are they worried about? The people that are going to help you in that first instance, who are going to feel something meaningful in your vision, what are they worried about? What are they preoccupied with? I have a deep sense that there are many people across, you know, the countries I know at the moment who are living in some form of resistance, yeah, who are checking out of public life in some way because it's just too much.
As you did.
As I did, yeah. Yeah, and there is no, let me be clear, there is no heroism here. This is not the resistance of heroism. Let's be clear. This is not the resistance of the people, the families who marched and walked onto the Maidan, the square in the middle of Kiev. Exactly, it's sort of 10 years ago to this month when the violence started. There is that resistance, which requires enormous courage, physical courage, knowing that by the end of this day, you might not be alive. That's one type of courage. I'm talking about a different sort of resistance where there is just too much going on in society that you fundamentally disagree with at the level of values that you just have to retreat in some way and find solace and sanity. So it's the resistance that keeps you sane. Now, that's fine up to a point, but then comes the intolerance where you say to yourself and amongst your friends, and you sense it more widely, perhaps through culture, through film and music, and that we can't go on like this, and that's where the resistance has to marshal itself and gather strength and become a moment of change. where you have to have the confidence to say, well, what if we were living like this, but we were not swimming against the tide? Yeah. What if we were swimming? How would that feel to swim in the direction of the current? Not because it would be more comfortable, or we could just sit back and float and the tide would take us along. No, I don't mean that. I mean, does somebody's everyday normal life in a democracy, in a prosperous democracy, does it have to be a struggle against the prevailing wind? That's the big question I'm trying to answer here. Do good people have to be swimming against the tide? Why does that have to be an act of resistance? Well, it is now, as a way of staying sane, retaining dignity and integrity. Yeah. But then it has to become, through intolerance, a moment of change, so that the resistance then becomes construction of something new. Mm-hmm. So from resistance to building.
So that's, again, another wonderful metaphor. Have you ever been on an inflatable raft on a body of water that is flowing?
A long time ago.
Yeah. Okay. So whether it's white water, that's extreme, or I'm envisioning a resort, and for children, I've never done this personally, but there is like a lazy, I think maybe it's a Disney thing, a lazy river where you get in on some sort of raft or floating device, and the water carries you where it chooses to carry you to, right? So you are completely submissive in that. You don't know where you're going to end up. You literally go with the flow. And when the flow is leading you to what you discern to be morally right or in line with your values, that may be one thing. But when it's not, and that current or that flow is still taking you irretrievably to in the opposite direction to where you know you should go, then being the effect of that, being subject to the effect of the flow, disempowers you, versus being the cause, knowing where, captaining the ship, so to speak, is a very different feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I'm immediately struck by the limits of language here, that swimming against the tide is helpful as a way to imagine resistance.
Right.
Less helpful when we're trying to talk about taking, regaining a sense of agency and a sense of purpose.
You become the current.
Yeah.
So if you think of current state of the world, back to your earlier question, preoccupation with, among those you know, the state of the world, the current state of fracture, devastation, even homelessness, there are many who, if they see it again, stand at the shoreline happening, watching it, if they see it unfold. And there are some like you who have no intolerance for it. Please read the three reference cards for the Illumify Game Changer.
Illumify, verb, to illuminate the change that matters most to you. Amplify it, so it also matters to those who can help realize it. And unify, to align in thought and action as a collective to ignite meaningful change. Enleven, verb, to rise up stronger, lift up, elevate, expand into greater awareness of consciousness and capability. The guidelines. Number one, answer from your heart, not from your head. Two, listen to yourself with care and focused attention. Three, do not judge the validity or viability of your answers. This is about expressing significant new initiatives or ideas that do not yet exist.
When you say that last part, Jonathan, do you see the chasm again?
I was very conscious of the last part. I was really focusing on those final words because I sense there's something very important here.
We remain in Amplify, Jonathan. We spent quite considerable length of, and depth of conversations on the who it is that you can express to who will willingly, not because you have any positional authority over them, but of their own volition, your vision will mean enough to them, so much to them, that they will choose to help you realize it, to think and act in the ways that help you realize. They then become, they form a collective. And as the emissary for the vision, you are responsible, because you see it, to first engage them, then align them in thought and action by guiding them to even the first steps of realizing your vision, where that new ground is, what it looks like, how to stand on it, etc. And then all of that is involved in mobilizing them. So the cards in Amplify are designed to enable you to speak to them. It's no longer about you. It's about them. So let's continue by reading card 27 in Amplify, please.
Why is this in their interests? Why is this in their interests? What's in it for others to want to invest their focus in helping you ignite meaningful change? Is it something that matters to their minds or to their hearts or to both? I can't know other people's interests, really. I have a clear sense that I can't know that. But, and this is following on from our previous conversation, which is still top of mind, yeah. I'm still feeling that conversation bouncing around my head. If I have certainty in my vision, and if, as I said, it's a public vision, I see my vision as a public vision, then it has to matter to their hearts first. I'm looking directly at the card here. Is it something that matters to their minds or to their hearts or to both? To their hearts, first and foremost. Why? Because that's where everything begins. And I don't mean this in a mushy, sentimental sort of way. Our decision-making begins in the heart. And if our decision-making begins in the heart, then something tells me also that when we receive a message, when we receive a story, that in a first instance, it's not a moment of rational analysis, but a moment of receiving something through the heart, in the heart. So I cannot know what's in their interests. I think each human struggles to figure out what their own interests are, their own best interests. But I get the question, and I'm not avoiding the question. I'm engaging with it further down the card in the prompt. You know, what's in it for others? What's in it for others to want to invest their focus, so their time, their energy in helping me ignite meaningful change? My starting point is the resonance here, the resonance. If the vision is right and truthful, and if I have found the right words to communicate it, then there is, for me, there is a necessity here. there is something necessary, that if it's true, that it will matter to people's hearts first and foremost. And that's what's in it for them, first and foremost. And in that first instance, that's what counts for me. I'm not sure I could go beyond that and start to articulate how that would then manifest itself for them in their lives in a more rational way, which is why I'm, in this first instance, I'm really focusing on their heart, and that it's something that matters to their heart.
Is that because you see the heart as the center of feeling? Feelings come from the heart?
Well, more than that, it's that we're all very comfortable, I think. We all share the metaphor of the heart. We talk about heart and soul as being very similar, and we often put them in opposition to the mind or the brain. I think that's often a false dichotomy, a false opposition. But what I do also feel is that the heart does come first, certainly when it comes to decision making. Mm-hmm. We had a good conversation about this in London, that even not just particular decisions, but lifelong beliefs held over a lifetime, you know, our moral inclinations to lean one way or the other are deeply, deeply embedded within us from birth. Yeah? From birth, that's my sense. And I find support for that in a lot of the reading I've done around neuroscience, modern psychology, what it's telling us. So that's why I'm going to the heart here. Not as something mushy and sentimental, but something that is deeply at the heart of decision-making and mm-hmm. human understanding.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're absolutely right that when it comes to decision-making, it's not the head that rules. Neuroscience, as you probably know, Jonathan, has confirmed, proven, that when we make a decision, it comes and has to come from the feeling center, which is the amygdala within the brain. And in fact, unless we feel something about that which we're making a decision on, unless we feel something, we can literally cannot make a decision. We have to feel something. So that runs contrary to most, quote, thinking right now, which is process, which is give them the facts. They'll just tell them, here, fill the slide with 4,000 data points, because that's evidence. Just give them the facts. You can give people the facts till the cows come home. They will not act. They will not make a decision unless they feel something. Facts are valid. Facts are important. What facts do is ground your feeling. They make the decision you're making credible for you, rational for you. But first you have to feel. So this question you focus so far on, is it coming? Is it something that matters to their minds or to their hearts or both? So you've landed on the heart. Awesome. Mm. Now let's go back to the question.
Why is this in their interests? Well, because for me, there's not a contradiction here. If in that first instance of communication, a first conversation, but perhaps also a rally, you know, we were half joking about rallies, and you said it yourself, Catherine, off record. The excitement of a rally, a dangerous thing. History tells us of very dangerous things. Mm. Yeah. The rally that is on the road to hell. Okay, yeah. we know that one.
Hitler was a master
of course, at
rallies.
There you go. Yeah. So we know that, but why is it important here? And what I'm resisting here, I was saying earlier, I said at some point previously that if somebody heard my vision and said at the end, yep, sounds good, sign me up, you know, that I'd feel utterly deflated by that reaction. Likewise, if somebody quickly saw how this was in their interest, I think, ooh, hang on, I've failed somewhere. yeah, this has got to play out in the real world at some point. This is a vision. It's not poetry. It's a vision. It's a vision for change, meaningful change. There is disruption here. We're breaking with the past. We're walking on new ground. So this ends up not just being in the real world, but changing it. And yet in this first instance here, where we are now in Amplify and where we are in the conversation, I think the reason I'm going towards the heart is that in this first instance, I wouldn't want people to be thinking about their interests. And
how interesting that you've taken it that way.
Yeah.
You're saying they would be motivated to act because they have a self-interest in it.
Well, no, I'm saying that the moment at which they step towards me and don't just say, huh, yeah, sounds good, sign me up, that there's more going on there.
Yeah.
Then, because that reaction sounds like somebody who's made a calculation. And as I said right at the beginning, can any human being know the interests of other people? I'm not sure. You know, what's in their interests? Why is this in their interests?
Look at the first line again in the prompt.
What's in it for others? What's in it for others to want to invest their focus? It would be, you know, at the risk of wading into the cliches of rallies, it's a moment of hope.
Okay, let's get out of rallies.
The possibility of change.
Let's move out of rallies.
Yeah.
Let's look at who you've identified.
Yeah.
The who. Who are the who again?
Well, we as a way of trying to give this shape and yeah. without naming target groups or individuals, mm-hmm. because they're the constituents that come later in the process, we use concentric circles. Mm-hmm. And in that first circle, the inner circle, and as I think about it now, not obviously, it was a deliberate choice. I don't think I was going for the obvious choice, but the deliberate choice is friends and family and friends.
Okay.
Why? Because of the nature of my vision, I think, but also how I've lived my life and how public concern and politics has been central to the conversations and the relationships over decades now with those people.
So why is this in their interests? Why would it matter to them that they help you, that they devote any part of themselves to helping you ignite it?
That it would ignite something within them.
Such as?
The possibility of action.
Now they could take any action. Why this action? Why this change? Why this being meaningful to them? Why would it be meaningful to them? Why would it be? So there are many levels of this question, Jonathan. We're now at the expressing. We're starting to begin. How do you express this? So when you speak, people have to hear you, right? They have to be willing to listen. And if we're not interested just on the very basic level in a subject matter, if someone, for example, were to say to me, oh, I've got so much to share with you about jujitsu, I think I'm not interested in that. Why would I care about jujitsu? I don't want to spend any of my time or focus listening to you. You have identified your meaningful change. Why is it in their interest to even begin to listen, let alone help you ignite it?
Go back to that moment where you were saying homeless people, when we go ground level, homeless people are often invisible and we walk by them. And one of the fears that makes that the reality we share now is that the person walking by the homeless person is afraid to become one day.
One step away, one degree of separation.
Would that be a basis for existing interests that they may have. Self-serving preservation, for example.
That's the most base level of this. Mm. Mm-hmm. And Catherine, is the premise there that if I can help eradicate homelessness, then I won't ever fall victim to it myself. Is that the premise?
Yeah, I'm going to the survival mechanism within humans and the denial of its existence. Why is the concept of home so innately important? Many won't have words around it. They will have fear around it. They will have the uprooting. They will have the disconnection from society, the loss of way to contribute, the worthlessness, the sense of lack of value, whatever it is that makes them fractured, fragmented, broken.
Themselves. Starting with themselves. Whether they have a roof over their head or not.
Yeah, I will play a card here, and this is an assumption. Working with what we've got, I don't know if this will be able to become a collective. The objective won't be for the collective. My sense is that it will always be self-serving, propelled by survival and one's fear of facing their greatest fears. When we look at it from that place of secret fear, no one wants to admit, and yet they all house it within themselves. I wouldn't necessarily vocalize it that way, frame it that way.
Good Lord, no. Okay.
Having said that, that's where it's going to hit.
So that also relates to our conversations, Jonathan, about loneliness and not feeling at home within oneself. So when you raise the concept, the vision of a shared home that provides a shared home for the homeless, at whatever level they are detached from home, and again, that's the primary, but there are also, and maybe base, depending on how they interpret it, those six dimensions. So why is it in their interest to listen and potentially help you ignite it?
Well, at some level because they feel the various forms of heartache that I have felt, and they also want to respond to that. And is the vision not giving them a key to respond to that? You know, that's why I talked about the possibility of action. Mm-hmm. What comes before the action? Something that, a key.
Well, so back to vision, and you see it. Do they see it the way you see it? Do they see it at all, generally speaking? What do you think?
Well, we've said that in defining the vision, we've said that the answer is necessarily no to that. It has to be no to that.
To that degree. Mm-hmm. So what you're doing, again, 2 degrees, is making what is invisible to them visible. They can begin just by virtue of hearing it. When you start to express it, they can begin to see it. Now, when you see something that you have been blind to, can that evoke feeling about it that maybe you've suppressed? Or maybe that feeling explains it, makes it more tangible. This is why I've felt that from within, that sense of fracturing that as I look around the world or as I walk through my own world, that I don't feel that sense of home in myself or others.
I mean, I don't like the word interest. here, because that is necessarily a private thing. So if my vision is in a very determined way public, and I hope infused with a sense of the public good, and if my hope is that it will resonate through that, through its sense of public concern, then I'm, this is why I'm rejecting the word interest.
Okay, let's go to the psychology of being broken. Is it more likely that someone who is crippled with their shattered state has enough in them to set their needs aside and contribute to a public good? And this really requires us to look at the human state of mind. How likely is that? Because for generations, and I know there's been bad stuff in our history, for generations past, humanity has not been in such a broken state as it is today. And to be able to reach them and mobilize them, as foreign or distant as it may sometimes feel, it is required of someone in your position, I know I'm being forceful here, to appreciate the human state of mind from a vantage point that you may not share. Otherwise, you won't reach them. Otherwise, you will have a gap between you and the public good and their crippled state. Is there anything you can do to connect those two places?
Well, the vision is about, if the vision works, my vision is about, it's not about dissolving the difference between public and private. We talked rightly at length about privacy. Privacy is a fundamental human need and is a fundamental human right. So I'm not denying that at all. That's critical. For me, where public comes in here is it through a revival, a rejuvenation of the notion of public, we find a way for people's private interests, private concerns, private actions are ultimately, and this is looking further down the line, how a vision of this sort would ultimately branch out into action. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But an important part of the vision is how do you harness individual private activity to a public good, to a social good.
And what if interests stem from the deepest of fears? What if they are ultimately self-serving? And what if that is where they can be reached right now? Crippled.
An interest in itself is not a good or a bad thing.
Can I read the definition of interest, because that may help you? A sense of concern with and curiosity is one thing, but here's more essentially: a reason for wanting something done. In this case, a reason for helping or acting to get something done.
Yes. And that, hearing that, I think is what triggered me to say, because of their own sense of the heartache. That's why I got to that point a few moments ago.
Okay.
So that out of their own sense of heartache, they want something done. And up until now, they may not have seen how.
Yeah.
But in the first...
Or what, even.
Yes. But it's there.
And again, whether it's for their own, to resolve their own heartache.
Or
the heartache of watching others around them in that state.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
I think that's a good place to stop.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
The word interest initially triggered a negative reaction from Jonathan. Who was he to determine what is of interest to other people? He ultimately sees that interest in itself isn't negative or positive. It's what can grab our attention and even compel us to act. The reality is that unless we are interested in something, for whatever reason, we don't want to hear about it. We tune out. And yes, that may reflect that we are primarily motivated by self-interest. That may, though, indeed be the very reason others ultimately do act on Jonathan's vision. It may not always be for their own direct benefit, though. It could also be that they just can't bear to see others struggling. He's found the key to unlocking action. Heartache. The leader's journey continues. Stay tuned. If listening to this Illumify Game Changer podcast is of value to you, please like it on this platform and share it with those who could ignite meaningful change. It's here, as am I, to be of service. I'm Marianne Gobet. Thank you for accompanying us on the Leader's Journey. To fully experience the passage to igniting meaningful change, subscribe to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. To learn more about the Illumify Game Changer and how to embark on your own leader's journey, please visit Illumify's website at illumifyinstitute.com. You matter. Step up. Speak up. Together, let's ignite meaningful change.